her grasp of constitutional issues. If Madison in the 1780s was a philosopher king, Madison in the 1790s was a formidable practicing politician, and so skillful at cutting deals that he was dubbed the Big Knife. Hamilton's followers, who feared Madison's ability to marshal votes, later called him the General, and Jefferson the Generalissimo. Congressman Zephaniah Swift of Connecticut later confirmed that Madison's lack of Hamiltonian verve could be deceptive. He has no fire, no enthusiasm, no animation, but he has infinite prudence and industry. With the greatest apparent candor, he calculates upon everything with the greatest nicety and precision. He has unquestionably the most personal influence of any man in the House of Representatives. I never knew a man that better understood how to husband a character and make the most of his talents. And he is the most artificial, studied character on earth. On four separate occasions between February and July 1790, the dexterous Madison thwarted attempts to enact assumption. People whispered into Hamilton's ear that Madison was jealous of his power, that Madison coveted his job. Time showed that political differences dwarfed personal considerations. Hamilton's funding plan brought state loyalties to the surface. Some states, such as Massachusetts and South Carolina, struggled with heavy debts and were glad to be relieved by the central government. Others, such as Virginia and North Carolina, had settled most of their debts and saw no reason to help. Such differences threatened to explode the brittle consensus that had been so arduous to reach at the Constitutional Convention. In defending his plan, Hamilton did not just speak in arid technical terms. He talked of justice, equity, patriotism, and national honor. His funding system was premised upon a simple concept, that the debt was generated by the Revolution, that all Americans had benefited equally from that Revolution, and that they should assume collective responsibility for its debt. If state debts were unequal, so were the sacrifices made during the fighting. Praising the immense exertions of indebted Massachusetts, for instance, Hamilton stated, "It would not be too strong to say that they were in a great degree the pivot of the Revolution." Some states, he noted, had paid their debts by ignoble means. New York, for instance, had reneged on interest payments to drive down the market value of its debt, making it cheaper for the state to buy it back. Hamilton also made a subtle, sophisticated argument that without assumption, indebted states would have to raise their taxes, while healthy states would lighten their tax loads. This would trigger a dangerous exodus of people from high-tax to low-tax states, producing a violent dislocation of the population of particular states. For Hamilton, assumption was his make-or-break issue, and the outlook looked grim. Hamilton recalled, "It happened that Mr. Madison and some other distinguished characters of the South started in opposition to the assumption. The high opinion entertained of them made it be taken for granted in that quarter that the opposition would be successful." Hamilton threw himself into battle with his accustomed impetuosity. In this exceptionally hard fight, Hamilton had to lead the charge without Washington. The president supported assumption but did not want to be accused of partisanship, and so hesitated to express a public opinion. To aggravate the problem, Washington was laid low in May with an attack of pneumonia so debilitating that, Jefferson said, he was pronounced by two of the three physicians present to be in the act of death. You cannot conceive of the public alarm on this occasion. From May 10th to June 24th, Washington was too feeble to record an entry in his diary, and Hamilton seemed to function as the de facto head of state. In unpublished comments on this period, Hamilton accused Jefferson of harboring presidential wishes during the interregnum. "Mr. Jefferson fears in Mr. Hamilton a formidable rival in the competition for the presidential chair at a future period. After he, Jefferson, entered on the duties of his station, the president was afflicted with a malady which, while it created dismay and alarm in the heart of every patriot, only excited the ambitious ardor of the secretary to remove out of his way every dangerous opponent. That melancholy circumstance suggested to him the probability of an approaching vacancy in the presidential chair, and that he would attract the public attention as the successor to it were the more popular secretary of the treasury out of the way." Perhaps Hamilton decided to suppress this recollection because it revealed his own presidential fantasies as well as Jefferson's. During Washington's illness, Hamilton and his minions, in a tremendous display of organizational skill, accosted congressmen and proselytized for assumption. The Treasury Secretary became a ubiquitous figure at Federal Hall, packing the gallery with supporters. Nobody was more offended than William McClay. In his journal, he castigated Hamilton as His Holiness, and on another occasion called him a damnable villain. Hamilton got off easy. John Adams reminded McClay of a monkey just put into breeches. On account of his whirling energy, Hamilton encountered enormous resistance from congressmen fearful of a strong executive branch. His activities brought to mind Robert Walpole, Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer in the 1720s, who achieved such omnipotence that he was the first to acquire the title of Prime Minister. In Philadelphia, Benjamin Rush deplored Hamilton's high-pressure lobbying. "I question whether more dishonorable influence has ever been used by a British minister, bribery excepted, to carry a measure than has been used to carry the report of the secretary. This influence is not confined to nightly visits, promises, compromises, sacrifices, and threats in New York." Alexander Hamilton was trying through his assumption plan to preserve the Union, and yet nobody, for the moment, seemed to be widening its divisions more. If politics is preeminently the art of compromise, then Hamilton was in some ways poorly suited for his job. He wanted to be a statesman who led courageously, not a politician who made compromises. Instead of proceeding with small, piecemeal measures, he had presented a gigantic package of fiscal measures that he wanted accepted all at once. As the newspaper war against Hamilton heated up, Madison's backers scented victory. On April 8th, William McClay gloated over the gloom of Hamilton's adherents. "I never observed so drooping an aspect, so turbid and forlorn an appearance as overspread the partisans of the secretary in our house this afternoon. Rufus King looked like a boy that had been whipped." McClay's exuberance was justified. On April 12, 1790, the House voted down Hamilton's assumption plan, 31-29, and 2 weeks later voted to discontinue all debate on the issue. By early June, it looked as if the assumption plan was heading for oblivion. So Hamilton began to search for a compromise that would salvage the linchpin of his economic program. The issue that he seized on was the divisive question of where the national capital should be located. At the Constitutional Convention, the delegates had decided to create a federal district, 10 miles square, in an unspecified location. This decision generated melodramatic speculation. Some people found the idea of a separate capital fraught with danger, fearing a privileged enclave. Governor George Clinton envisioned the 10 Mile Square as the scene of a presidential court, disfigured by royal trappings and marked by ambition with idleness, baseness with pride, the thirst of riches without labor, flattery, treason, perfidy, but above all, the perpetual ridicule of virtue. The Capitol's location had already led to intensive lobbying and intrigue. It was a monumental decision for contestants, since it would confer massive wealth, power, and population upon the winning state. More important, it would affect the style of the federal government, which was bound to soak up some of the political atmosphere of the surrounding region. In a large country with poor transportation, the voices of local citizens would resonate loudly in the ears of federal legislators. Complicating the debate was the expectation that there would first be a temporary capital, likely New York or Philadelphia, which would function as the makeshift seat of government while a permanent capital was readied. Notwithstanding his nationalist bent, Hamilton wanted New York to remain at least the temporary capital. In August 1788, he contacted his old mentor, Governor William Livingston of New Jersey, and expressed shock at reports that Livingston had capitulated to the snares of Pennsylvania and was leaning toward Philadelphia as temporary capital for the first Congress. The northeastern states feared the enhanced power that would accrue to Pennsylvania if it housed the temporary capital, which might then prove permanent. Before Livingston, Hamilton dangled a tantalizing deal. If he supported New York City as temporary capital, Hamilton would endorse Trenton, New Jersey as the long-term capital. Hamilton's desire to have the capital in New York intensified as Washington's inauguration neared. In February 1789, he made a spirited campaign speech for his friend John Lawrence, then running for Congress from New York City, and urged that as the residence of Congress would doubtless be esteemed a matter of some import to the city of New York, our representative should be a man well qualified in oratory to prove that this city is the best station for that honorable body. By January 17, 1790, with the uproar mounting over Hamilton's funding scheme, William McClay believed that Hamilton, emboldened by his burgeoning power, was determined to retain New York as the capital. "I have attended in the minutest manner to the motions of Hamilton and the New Yorkers. Sincerity is not with them. They will never consent to part with Congress." In this tussle, New York was a controversial choice. It was becoming so associated with Hamilton that his enemies branded it Hamiltonopolis. For many Southerners, Jefferson in particular, New York City was an Anglophile bastion dominated by bankers and merchants who would contaminate the Republican experiment. These critics equated New York with the evils of London. Benjamin Rush, a Philadelphia booster, told Madison, "I am satisfied that the influence of our city will be against the Treasury Secretary's system of injustice and corruption. Philadelphia will be better ground to combat the system on than New York." The question of the capital served as a proxy for the question of whether America should assume an urban or agrarian character. Many Southerners believed that a northern capital would favor the mercantile, moneyed urban interests and discriminate against agrarian life. Jefferson's pastoral dream of a nation of small, independent farms had a powerful appeal to the American psyche, however much it differed from the slaveholding reality of the South. Jefferson, Madison, and Washington wanted a permanent capital on the Potomac, not far from Mount Vernon. For Jefferson, this would plant the nation's capital in a bucolic setting safe from abolitionist forces and the temptations of any overgrown commercial city. Madison and Henry Lee speculated in land on the Potomac, hoping to earn a windfall profit if the area was chosen for the capital. There were other political questions to consider. Should the capital be near the population or the geographic center of America? New York was scarcely equidistant from the northern and southern tips of the country. 16 of the 24 original senators came from south of the city, and this would present hardships for southern delegates who had to travel long distances. The choice of the capital was also seen as a referendum on America's future growth. For those who believed that the country would expand westward, a view especially prevalent in the southern states, whose western borders functioned as gateways to the frontier, a northeast capital would poorly serve America's future political landscape. All these simmering issues came to the surface during the ensuing debate. During the spring of 1790, quarrels over Assumption and the national capital grew so vitriolic that it did not seem far-fetched that the Union might break up over the issues. The South increasingly fired at Hamilton the same vituperative rhetoric once directed at the British. In writing to Madison, Henry Lee stated that the battle to stop Assumption brought back memories of the Revolution. "It seems to me that we Southern people must be slaves in effect or cut the Gordian knot at once." Jefferson long remembered the sour mood that hung like a miasma over New York that spring. "Congress met and adjourned from day to day without doing anything, the parties being too much out of temper to do business together." Of the two policies that Hamilton wished to promote, the federal assumption of state debt and the selection of New York as the capital, assumption was incomparably more important to him. It was the most effective and irrevocable way to yoke the states together into a permanent union. So when he saw that Madison possessed the votes to block Assumption, Hamilton considered bargaining away New York as the capital in exchange for Southern support for Assumption. As early as May 16th, glimmers of a deal emerged in a letter from Philip Schuyler to Stephen Van Rensselaer. "No motion has yet been brought forward to remove the seat of government, but we apprehend that, if the Assumption is not carried, that the South Carolinians may, in order to obtain an object which is so important to them, negotiate with those who wish the removal." 9 days later, William McClay reported frantic negotiations. The New Yorkers are now busy in the scheme of bargaining with the Virginians, offering the permanent seat on the Potomac for the temporary one in New York. On June 2, 1790, the House enacted Hamilton's funding bill without the assumption component. Hamilton knew he had to strike a deal quickly. Reluctant to surrender his reputation for uncompromising stands, he relied on deputies to make the conciliatory overtures. In the early republic, it was difficult for politicians to engage in legislative maneuvering that later became standard practice, so Hamilton dispatched emissaries to sound out Robert Morris, the Pennsylvania senator and a leading proponent of Philadelphia as the capital. "I did not choose to trust them," Morris said, "but wrote a note to Colonel Hamilton that I would be walking early in the morning on the Battery, and if Colonel Hamilton had anything to propose to him, he might meet him there." To Morris's surprise, Hamilton was already at the rendezvous spot when he arrived. Hamilton's deal was simple. If Morris rounded up one vote in the Senate and five in the House for assumption, he would back Germantown or Trenton, both hard by Philadelphia, as the permanent capital. Hamilton had now tipped his hand as the master strategist behind the bargaining over the capital. Pennsylvania Congressman Peter Muhlenberg told Benjamin Rush, "It is now established beyond a doubt that the Secretary of the Treasury guides the movements of the Eastern Phalanx." What likely scuttled Hamilton's deal was that the Pennsylvania and Virginia delegations had already reached an understanding. Philadelphia would become the temporary capital and the Potomac site the permanent capital. This was the very solution Hamilton had worked to avoid because it rejected a role for New York and placed the long-term capital in the South. The Pennsylvania legislators probably consented from a wishful hunch that the capital, once placed temporarily in Philadelphia, would be difficult to dislodge. By June 18th, having surrendered hope of a permanent capital on the Delaware, Hamilton was slowly coming around to the Potomac site. That day, William McClay reported that Hamilton affects to tell Mr. Morris that the New England men will bargain to fix the permanent seat at the Potomac or at Baltimore. It was against this backdrop of an emerging consensus that one must evaluate the famous anecdote told by Jefferson about the dinner bargain that fixed the capital on the Potomac. According to Jefferson, the northern states were threatening secession and dissolution when he ran into a ragged Hamilton outside Washington's residence. Usually, Hamilton was dapper and polished. Now, to Jefferson's amazement, he was despondent and unkempt. His look was somber, haggard, and dejected. Even his dress uncouth and neglected. Hamilton seemed in despair. "He walked me backwards and forwards before the president's door for half an hour. He painted pathetically the temper into which the legislature had been wrought, the disgust of those who were called creditor states, the danger of the secession of their members and the separation of the states. He observed that the members of the administration ought to act in concert, that though this question was not of my department, yet a common duty should make it a common concern. That the question having been lost by a small majority only, it was probable that an appeal from me to the judgment and discretion of some of my friends might effect a change in the vote." If assumption faltered, Hamilton hinted, he might have to resign. Jefferson blandly informed Hamilton that he was really a stranger to the whole subject of assumption. Jefferson was very adroit at presenting himself as a political naif, when he had in fact followed the debate intently and had just written George Mason urging a compromise on the matter. Doubtless with this in mind, he invited the Treasury Secretary to dine at his home the next day. If we are to credit Jefferson's story, the dinner held at his lodgings on Maiden Lane on June 20, 1790, fixed the future site of the Capitol. It is perhaps the most celebrated meal in American history, the guests including Jefferson, Madison, Hamilton, and perhaps one or two others. For more than a month, Jefferson had been bedeviled by a migraine headache, yet he presided with commendable civility. Despite his dislike of assumption, he knew that the stalemate over the funding scheme could shatter the Union, and as Secretary of State, he also feared the repercussions for American credit abroad. Madison restated his familiar argument that assumption punished Virginia and other states that had duly settled their debts. But he agreed to support assumption, or at least not oppose it, if something were granted in exchange. Jefferson recalled, "It was observed that as the pill would be a bitter one to the southern states, something should be done to soothe them." The sedative measure was that Philadelphia would be the temporary capital for 10 years, followed by a permanent move to a Potomac site. In a lucrative concession for his home state, Madison also seems to have extracted favorable treatment for Virginia in a final debt settlement with the central government. In return, Hamilton agreed to exert his utmost efforts to get the Pennsylvania congressional delegation to accept Philadelphia as the provisional capital and a Potomac site as its permanent successor. The dinner consecrated a deal that was probably already close to achievement. The sad irony was that Hamilton, the quintessential New Yorker, bargained away the city's chance to be another London or Paris, the political as well as financial and cultural capital of the country. His difficult compromise testified to the transcendent value he placed on assumption. The decision did not sit well with many New Yorkers. Senator Rufus King was enraged when Hamilton told him that he had made up his mind to jettison the capital to save his funding system. For King, Hamilton's move had been high-handed and secretive, and he ranted privately that great and good schemes ought to succeed not by intrigue or the establishment of bad measures. True to his dinner pledge, Hamilton applied his persuasive powers to the Pennsylvania delegation. Maclay's journal is again invaluable in tracking these closed-door deliberations. When he discovered that Hamilton had linked the abominations of his funding scheme with the Potomac capital, he berated Washington as a tool of Hamilton and the dish clout of every dirty speculation. In the Senate on June 23rd, Maclay noticed that Robert Morris was summoned from the chamber. "He at last came in and whispered to me, 'The business is settled at last. Hamilton gives up the temporary residence for New York.'" The next day, the Pennsylvania congressional delegation bowed to the compromise that was to make Philadelphia the temporary capital for 10 years. To clinch the deal, Hamilton, Jefferson, and Secretary of War Knox dined with the Pennsylvanians on June 28th. Maclay's recollections of that dinner are instructive. He found Jefferson stiff and formal, possessed of a lofty gravity. He warmed more to the fat, easygoing Knox, who may have drunk to excess. Maclay calls him bacchanalian, yet managed to project an aura of dignity. The description of Hamilton is suggestive. "Hamilton has a very boyish, giddy manner, and Scotch-Irish people could call him a skite." The Oxford English Dictionary defines the Scottish word skite as meaning a vain, frivolous, or wanton girl. The choice of words hints at something feminine about Hamilton beneath the military bearing, an androgynous quality noted by others. The description also suggests that Hamilton had gone from abject despair to inexpressible elation as he won final backing for his funding scheme. On July 10, 1790, the House approved the Residence Act, designating Philadelphia as the temporary capital and a 10-mile square site on the Potomac as the permanent site. A disenchanted Maclay concluded that Hamilton was now all-powerful. "His gladiators have wasted us months in this place. Everything, even to the naming of a committee, is prearranged by Hamilton and his group of speculators." On July 26th, the House narrowly passed the Assumption Bill. The famous dinner deal had worked its political magic. Madison voted against Hamilton's measure, but arranged for 4 congressmen from Virginia and Maryland to change their votes in favor of Assumption. In retrospect, it was a splendid moment for Hamilton, Madison, and Jefferson. They had devised a statesmanlike solution that averted disintegration of the Union. In this idealistic dawn of the Republic, however, such a compromise evoked howls of execration. Any backdoor deal savored of corruption, and legislators anxiously awaited the public response. Thomas Fitzsimons of the Pennsylvania delegation feared that stones would be thrown at him in Philadelphia because he had gone along with the Potomac capital. On the New York streets, the Pennsylvanians endured obscene epithets shouted by pedestrians disgusted at losing the temporary capital, New York City having already broken ground on a new presidential mansion. Among the most aggrieved New Yorkers was Philip Schuyler, who bewailed a want of that decency which was due to a city whose citizens made very capital exertions for the accommodation of Congress. Jefferson would have to defend to posterity his complicity in a deal that weakened the states. He could have cited the peril to the Union and left it at that. Instead, he decided to scapegoat Hamilton. Of his own part in passing the Assumption Bill, he later told Washington, "I was duped into it by the Secretary of the Treasury and made a tool for forwarding his schemes, not then sufficiently understood by me, and of all the errors of my political life, this has occasioned me the deepest regret." In 1818, Jefferson made the point still more graphically. Through Assumption, Hamilton had thrown a lucrative sop to the stock-jobbing herd. This added to the number of votaries of the Treasury and made its chief the master of every vote in the legislature which might give to the government the direction suited to his political views. Jefferson traced the formation of the two main parties, to be known as Republicans and Federalists, to Hamilton's victory over Assumption. For Jefferson, this event split Congress into pure, virtuous Republicans and a mercenary phalanx, monarchists in principle, who adhered to Hamilton, of course, as their leader in that principle. Why did Jefferson retrospectively try to downplay his part in passing Hamilton's Assumption scheme? While he understood the plan at the time better than he admitted, he probably did not see as clearly as Hamilton that the scheme created an unshakable foundation for federal power in America. The federal government had captured forever the bulk of American taxing power. In comparison, the location of the national capital seemed a secondary matter. It was not that Jefferson had been duped by Hamilton. Hamilton had explained his views at dizzying length. It was simply that he had been outsmarted by Hamilton, who had embedded an enduring political system in the details of the funding scheme. In an unsigned newspaper article that September, entitled Address to the Public Creditors, Hamilton gave away the secret of his statecraft that so infuriated Jefferson. "Whoever considers the nature of our government with discernment will see that though obstacles and delays will frequently stand in the way of the adoption of good measures, yet when once adopted, they are likely to be stable and permanent. It will be far more difficult to undo than to do." The dinner deal to pass Assumption and establish the capital on the Potomac was the last time that Hamilton, Jefferson, and Madison ever cooperated to advance a common agenda. Henceforth, they found themselves in increasingly open warfare. Chapter 17. The First Town in America. After passage of his funding program, Hamilton did not stop to take a breather from his work. This intensely driven man, always compensating for his deprived early years, had a mind that throbbed incessantly with new ideas. When it came to issues confronting America, he committed all the resources of his mind. Hamilton could not do things halfway. He cared too passionately, too personally, about the fate of his adopted country. Inside his teeming brain, he found it hard to strike a balance between the grand demands of his career and the small change of everyday life. The endless letters that flowed from his pen are generally abstract and devoid of imagery. He almost never described weather or scenery, the clothing or manners of people he met, the furniture of rooms he inhabited. He scarcely ever alluded to days off, vacations, or leisure moments. In one letter, he told Angelica that his favorite wish was to visit Europe one day, but he never left the country and seldom ventured beyond Albany or Philadelphia. Only rarely did he enliven letters with anecdotes or idle chatter. It was not so much that Hamilton was writing for the ages, though surely he knew his place in the larger scheme of things, as that his grandiose plans left scant space for commonplace thoughts. Soon after Hamilton became Treasury Secretary, Philip Schuyler told Eliza a comical story about her husband's absent-minded behavior in an upstate New York town where he once paused en route to Albany. Hamilton must have been composing a legal brief or speech in his mind, for he kept pacing in front of a store owned by Mr. Rogers. As one observer recalled, "Apparently in deep contemplation and his lips moving as rapidly as if he was in conversation with some person, He entered the store and tendered a $50 bill to be exchanged. Rogers refused to change it. The gentleman, Hamilton, retired. A person in the store asked Rogers if the bill was counterfeited. He replied in the negative. "Why, then, did you not oblige the gentleman by exchanging it?" "Because," said Rogers, "the poor gentleman has lost his reason." "But," said the other, "he appeared perfectly natural." "That may be," said Rogers. "He probably has his lucid intervals. But I have seen him walk before my door for half an hour, sometimes stopping, but always talking to himself. And if I had changed the money and he had lost it, I might have received blame." As the main architect of the new American government, Hamilton was usually in harness to his work. A recurring theme among the Schuylers was that Eliza should coax her husband into getting some fresh air and exercise to relieve his overtaxed brain. In 1791, Henry Lee sent Hamilton a horse from Virginia so that, for health reasons, he could take daily airings and short rides. An excellent horseman who had ridden a great deal in the Revolution, Hamilton had asked Lee to send him an especially gentle horse. Hamilton still suffered from a recurring kidney ailment that one friend described as his old nephritic complaint, and that made jolting carriage rides an agonizing experience. Midway through Washington's first term, Angelica Church heard reports of Hamilton growing puffy from overwork. "Colonel Beckwith tells me that our dear Hamilton writes too much and takes no exercise and grows too fat," she complained to Eliza. "I hate both the word and the thing, and you will take care of his health and good looks. Why, I shall find him on my return a dull, heavy fellow." This man who worked with feverish, all-consuming energy could be the soul of conviviality after hours. William Sullivan left a verbal sketch of Hamilton that points up his incongruous blend of manly toughness and nearly feminine delicacy. "He was under middle size, thin in person, but remarkably erect and dignified in his deportment. His hair was turned back from his forehead, powdered, and collected in a club behind. His complexion was exceedingly fair and varying from this only by the almost feminine rosiness of his cheeks. His might be considered, as to figure and color, an uncommonly handsome face." In describing one social gathering they attended, Sullivan said that Hamilton made a dramatic late entrance and was alternately the deep thinker and the witty conversationalist, especially when the ladies watched him adoringly. When he entered the room, it was apparent from the respectful attention of the company that he was a distinguished individual. He was dressed in a blue coat with bright buttons. The skirts of his coat were unusually long. He wore a white waistcoat, black silk small clothes, white silk stockings. The gentleman who received him as a guest introduced him to such of the company as were strangers to him. To each he made a formal bow, bending very low, the ceremony of shaking hands not being observed. At dinner, whenever he engaged in conversation, everyone listened attentively. His mode of speaking was deliberate and serious, and his voice engagingly pleasant. In the evening of the same day, he was in a mixed assembly of both sexes, and the tranquil reserve noticed at the dinner table had given place to a social and playful manner, as though in this he was alone ambitious to excel. Most people found Hamilton highly agreeable. Sullivan wrote, "Those who could speak of his manner from the best opportunities to observe him in public and private concurred in pronouncing him to be a frank, amiable, high-minded, open-hearted gentleman. In private and friendly intercourse, he is said to have been exceedingly amiable and to have been affectionately beloved." The few unflattering portraits of Hamilton's personality tend to stem, not surprisingly, from political enemies. Hamilton was a man of daunting intellect and emphatic opinions, and John Quincy Adams contended that it was hard to get along with him if you disagreed with him. Hamilton knew he had a dogmatic streak and once joked, writing about himself in the third person, "Whatever may be the good or ill qualities of that officer, much flexibility of character is not of the number." John Adams perhaps saw in Hamilton the mirror of his own vanity, later telling Jefferson that he was an insolent coxcomb who rarely dined in good company where there was good wine without getting silly and vaporing about his administration, like a young girl about her brilliance and trinkets. On the other hand, Hamilton had scores of faithful friends. Governor Morris, Rufus King, Nicholas Fish, Egbert Benson, Robert Troop, William Dewar, Richard Varick, Oliver Wolcott Jr., Elias Boudinot, William Baird, Timothy Pickering, and James Kent, to name but a few. Throughout his career, he accumulated companions drawn to him by his humorous and almost feminine traits, his grandson observed. James Wilkinson, who patched things up with Hamilton after their wartime clash, once told Hamilton that he missed his company because I have never discovered in another so much matter to captivate the understanding and manner to charm the heart. In view of the heartless image of Hamilton propagated by political opponents, it is worth noting the numerous acts of generosity strewn throughout his correspondence. Thanking him for an unspecified act of disinterested friendship, Morgan Lewis told Hamilton, "Indeed, if my memory does not fail me, I may with truth assert the present instance as the only one I ever experienced." After Hamilton bailed out James Tillery with a loan, the New York physician tipped his hat. "You lent me some money to serve me at a time when an act of friendship had embarrassed me, and I now return it to you with 1,000 thanks." Hamilton also did favors for humble people, as when he drolly recommended his barber, John Wood, to George Washington's secretary. "He desires to have the honor of dealing with the heads and chins of some of your family, and I give him this line to make him known to you." Given his imposing responsibilities, it is hard to imagine that Hamilton could have enjoyed a warm, happy social life without Eliza's support. They created an elegant but unostentatious home filled with lovely furniture, including chairs in Louis XVI style and a federal mahogany sofa. Among other ornaments, they had a china snuffbox from Frederick the Great, courtesy of Baron von Steuben, a portrait of Louis XVI, a gift from the French ambassador, and later on, a stately Gilbert Stuart painting of George Washington. From London, Angelica Church showered them with exquisite items, including gold-embossed porcelain tableware and blue and gold French flower pots. Eliza would gladly have devoted herself to private life alone, but she submitted good-naturedly to the demands of her husband's career. She was always a sprightly presence at tea parties given by Martha Washington. She reminisced in old age, "I had little of private life in those days. Mrs. Washington, who, like myself, had a passionate love of home and domestic life, often complained of the waste of time she was compelled to endure. They call me the first lady in the land, and I think I must be extremely happy," she would say almost bitterly at times, and add, "they might more properly call me the chief state prisoner." As I was younger than she, I mingled more in the gaieties of the day. Martha Washington's style of entertaining struck Eliza as possessing just the right amalgam of beauty, taste, and modesty. One of Eliza's few surviving personal effects is a pair of pink satin slippers that Martha Washington left at the Schuyler Mansion and that Eliza gratefully inherited. As energetic as her husband, Eliza never complained about family demands. By the time Hamilton became Treasury Secretary, she had already given birth to 4 of their 8 children. Eliza was an excellent housekeeper who ably governed a large household. James McHenry once teased Hamilton about reports that Eliza has as much merit as your treasurer as you have as treasurer of the wealth of the United States. Hamilton appreciated her steady contributions to his life. In frequent letters to her, he constantly inquired about her in solicitous, protective tones. He seldom mentioned his work as if wishing to shield her from the rough and tumble of politics. The bulk of the child-rearing fell to Eliza, a strict but loving mother. On one occasion, she told a family friend that there is a hazard in young people having their evenings to themselves until they know there is a friend that will observe and advise them. But even with his time-consuming career, Hamilton did not fob off all the parenting duties on Eliza. When they were in separate cities, he often kept 1 or 2 of the older boys with him, allowing them to share his bed at night, while the younger children remained with their mother. Hamilton was a chronic worrier about his family, an emotion perhaps held over from his childhood. Angelica once commented to Eliza about her brother-in-law, "His sensibility suffers from the least anxiety to you or your babies." Hamilton enjoyed tutoring his children. He had high expectations and wanted them to excel. He was, by nature, an exacting, ambitious person, but his handful of surviving letters to them also show patient affection. After his eldest son, Philip, went off at age 9 to boarding school in Trenton in 1791, accompanied by Alexander Jr., Hamilton received a letter from him, saying how contented he was. Hamilton replied, "Your teacher also informs me that you recited a lesson the first day you began, very much to his satisfaction. I expect every letter from him will give me a fresh proof of your progress, for I know you can do a great deal if you please. And I am sure you have too much spirit not to exert yourself that you may make us every day more and more proud of you." Hamilton did not assume that his children would emulate his outsize accomplishments and tailored his demands to their native endowments, gently molding their characters. When his daughter Angelica was 9 and staying with Grandfather Schuyler in Albany, Hamilton took time from his duties to write this mildly didactic note. "I was very glad to learn, my dear daughter, that you are going to begin the study of the French language. We hope you will in every respect behave in such a manner as will secure to you the goodwill and regard of all those with whom you are. If you happen to displease any of them, be always ready to make a frank apology. But the best way is to act with so much politeness, good manners, and circumspection as never to have an occasion to make any apology. Your mother joins in best love to you. Adieu, my very dear daughter." The sensitivity and tact that Hamilton revealed as a father are the more remarkable considering the troubled circumstances of his own childhood, and he made it a point of honor never to break promises to his children. Hamilton loved the arts and shared this interest with his children. Very musically inclined, he had Angelica Church search London for the best piano she could find for his daughter Angelica. Singing duets became their favorite pastime. Hamilton also had an appreciative eye for art. "I know Hamilton likes the beautiful in every way," Angelica Church once told Eliza. "The beauties of nature and of art are not lost on him." Hamilton counseled Martha Washington on purchases of paintings and assembled his own collection of woodcuts and copper engravings, including works by Montaigne and Dürer. Just as he and Eliza had rescued Ralph Earle from debtor's prison in the 1780s, so they later scouted out work for William Winstanley, a British painter specializing in Hudson River scenes. Hamilton loaned money to the young artist and may have been responsible for 2 of his paintings that graced Martha Washington's drawing room. Another leitmotif of Hamilton's private life was his constant support of educational and scholarly pursuits. On January 21st, 1791, he was admitted to the American Philosophical Society, the country's oldest learned organization. Academic honors tumbled in on this man who had never officially finished college. Already a trustee of Columbia College, he now harvested a succession of honorary doctorates from Columbia, Dartmouth, Princeton, Harvard, and Brown, all before the tender age of 40. Through his interest in educating Native Americans, Hamilton's name came to adorn a college. During the Revolution, Philip Schuyler had negotiated with Indian tribes around Albany to guarantee their neutrality. For his translator and emissary, he often enlisted the cooperation of the Reverend Samuel Kirkland, a missionary to the Six Nation Iroquois League. Especially close to the Oneida, Kirkland wooed them to the patriotic side. Hamilton had championed a humane, enlightened policy toward the Indians. When real estate speculators had wanted to banish them from western New York, he warned Governor Clinton that the Indians' friendship alone can keep our frontiers in peace. The attempt at the total expulsion of so desultory a people is as chimerical as it would be pernicious. He was often outraged by depredations perpetrated by frontier settlers against the Indians. In one later speech drafted for Washington, he wrote that government policy had been inadequate to protect the Indians from the violences of the irregular and lawless part of the frontier inhabitants. When problems with the Indians arose, he always favored reconciliation before any resort to force. With such sympathy for the Indians' plight, Hamilton was receptive when Kirkland approached him in January 1793 to join the board of trustees of a new school in upstate New York to educate white and Native American students. The latter would be taught both English and Indian languages. Kirkland wrote in his journal, "Mr. Hamilton cheerfully consents to be a trustee of the said seminary and will afford it all the aid in his power." That same month, the New York legislature granted a charter for the Hamilton Oneida Academy. The following year, Baron von Steuben, acting as Hamilton's ambassador, laid the school's cornerstone. Hamilton never actually visited the school, but his sponsorship was significant enough that the school was christened Hamilton College when it received a broad new charter in 1812. The residence law that passed Congress in July 1790, establishing Philadelphia as the interim capital, dictated that all government offices relocate there by early December. The federal government did not decamp all at once and straggled off to Pennsylvania in a disorderly exodus. On August 12, 1790, Congress held its farewell session in Federal Hall. By the end of the month, President Washington had boarded a barge and waved his farewell to Manhattan. On September 1st, surely with an audible sigh of relief, Jefferson and Madison fled the sinful haunts of Manhattan and began to roll south across New Jersey in a four-wheeled carriage. Abigail Adams, who did not set sail until November, seemed miffed by the enforced southward shift, swearing that she would try to enjoy Philadelphia, but that when all is done, it will not be Broadway. In reality, Philadelphia was a cosmopolitan city, praised by a high-born British visitor as one of the wonders of the world, the first town in America, and one that bids fair to rival almost any in Europe. Larger than either New York or Boston, it supported 10 newspapers and 30 bookshops. Largely through the civic imagination of Benjamin Franklin, it boasted an astounding panoply of cultural and civic institutions, including two theaters, a subscription library, a volunteer fire company, and a hospital. As chieftain of the biggest government department, Hamilton executed the shift to Philadelphia with almost martial precision. In early August, he secured a two-story brick building on 3rd Street, between Chestnut and Walnut Streets. Though now headquarters of the most powerful government ministry, the building had a curiously makeshift air, as noted by the visitors Hamilton received between 9 o'clock and 12 o'clock each morning. One French caller, Moreau de Saint-Marie, was astounded that the official lodgings of a minister could be so poor. He was surprised when a shuffling old retainer answered the front door. And of Hamilton's plain ground-floor office, he wrote, "His desk was a plain pine table covered with a green cloth. Planks and trestles held records and papers, and at one end was a little imitation Chinese vase and a plate with glasses on it. In a word, I felt I saw Spartan customs all about me." From modest origins, the Treasury offices proliferated until they occupied the entire block. The 1791 City Directory gives an anatomy of this burgeoning department, with 8 employees in Hamilton's office, 13 in the comptroller's, 15 in the auditor's, 19 in the register's, 3 in the treasurer's, 14 in the office for settling accounts between the federal government and the states, and 21 in the customs office on 2nd Street, with an additional 122 customs collectors and surveyors scattered in various ports. By the standards of the day, this represented a prodigious bureaucracy. For its critics, it was a monster in the making, inciting fears that the department would become the Treasury Secretary's personal spy force and military machine. Swollen by the Customs Service, the Treasury Department payroll ballooned to more than 500 employees under Hamilton, while Henry Knox had a mere dozen civilian employees in the War Department, and Jefferson a paltry 6 at State, along with 2 chargés d'affaires in Europe. The corpulent Knox and his entire staff were squeezed into tiny New Hall, just west of the mighty Treasury complex. Inevitably, the man heading a bureaucracy many times larger than the rest of the government combined would arouse opposition, no matter how prudent his style. The hard-working secretary informed merchant Walter Stewart that he wanted a house for his family as near my destined office as possible. Reared in the tropics, he was now a confirmed resident of the northern latitudes and had taken on the identity of a New Yorker. A cool situation and exposure will, of course, be a very material point to a New Yorker, he advised Stewart. The house must have at least 6 rooms. Good dining and drawing rooms are material articles. I like elbow room in a yard. As to the rent, the lower the better, consistently with the acquisition of a proper house. By October 14th, Hamilton had taken a home at 3rd and Walnut, just down the block from his office, as if he wished to stumble from bed straight into his office. The move was indicative of how conscientious he was and how crowded his schedule. History has celebrated his Treasury tenure for his masterful state papers, but probably nothing devoured more of his time during his first year than creating the Customs Service. This towering intellect scrawled more mundane letters about lighthouse construction than about any other single topic. This preoccupation seems peculiar until it is recalled that import duties accounted for 90% of government revenues. No customs revenue, no government programs. Hence, Hamilton's unceasing vigilance about everything pertaining to trade. Congress had authorized Hamilton to keep in good repair the lighthouses, beacons, buoys, and public piers in the several states, and he hired and supervised those assigned to care for them. He also wielded huge patronage powers in awarding contracts for these navigational aids. In creating a string of beacons, buoys, and lighthouses along the Atlantic seaboard, Hamilton reviewed each contract and got Washington's approval, an administrative routine that stifled the two men with maddening minutiae. On the day after the famous dinner deal on Assumption and the nation's capital, Hamilton asked Washington to initial a contract for timber, boards, nails, and workmanship for a beacon near the Sandy Hook Lighthouse outside New York Harbor. Hamilton became expert on such excruciating banalities as the best whale oil, wicks, and candles to brighten lighthouse beams. Before the Revolution, smuggling had been a form of patriotic defiance against Britain, and colonists had cordially detested customs collectors. Now Hamilton had to correct these lawless habits. He asked Congress in April 1790 to commission a fleet of single-masted vessels called revenue cutters that would patrol offshore waters and intercept contraband. By early August, Washington had signed a bill setting up this service, later known as the Coast Guard. Hamilton advised Washington to avoid regional favoritism by constructing the first 10 revenue cutters in different parts of the Union. Previewing his upcoming industrial policy, he recommended using homegrown cloth for sails rather than foreign fabrics. Once again, an instinct for executive leadership, an innate capacity to command, surfaced in Hamilton. He issued directives of breathtaking specificity, requiring that each cutter possess 10 muskets and bayonets, 20 pistols, 2 chisels, 1 broadaxe, and 2 lanterns. Showing a detailed knowledge of seafaring ways that surely dated back to his Caribbean days, he instructed customs collectors that since cutters might be blown off course even to the West Indies, it will be always proper that they have salted meat with biscuit and water on board sufficient to subsist them in case of such an accident. In constructing the Coast Guard, Hamilton insisted on rigorous professionalism and irreproachable conduct. He knew that if revenue cutter captains searched vessels in an overbearing fashion, this high-handed behavior might sap public support, so he urged firmness tempered with restraint. He reminded skippers to always keep in mind that their countrymen are free men and as such are impatient of everything that bears the least mark of a domineering spirit. You will therefore refrain from whatever has the semblance of haughtiness, rudeness, or insult. So masterly was Hamilton's directive about boarding foreign vessels that it was still being applied during the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. Hamilton's power as head of customs extended beyond his legion of employees. Equally important was the comprehensive view of economic activity that he gained in a large country hobbled by primitive communications. 7 of every 8 Treasury Department employees worked outside the Capitol, supplying Hamilton with an unending stream of valuable intelligence. One of Jefferson's chief political operatives, John Beckley, reviled this network as an organized system of espionage through the medium of revenue officers. To monitor government receipts, Hamilton insisted upon weekly reports from collectors, enabling him to track every ship passing through American ports. With his insatiable curiosity, he wanted to know the size, strength, and construction of ships, their schedules and trading routes and cargoes. He pioneered questionnaires to gather such data. Hamilton also arbitrated innumerable disputes that arose with shippers, often wading into arcane legal issues. At one point, the Baltimore customs collector asked whether import duties should be levied on horses, and Hamilton decided that horses and livestock qualified as taxable objects of trade. He then made this further observation. I think it, however, necessary to observe that I consider Negroes to be exempted from duties on importation. It is a sorry commentary that the question of imposing duties on horses immediately posed the question of how to treat slaves. The Customs Service also invested Hamilton with huge influence over the monetary system, with tremendous sums passing through his hands. One apprehensive Virginian warned Madison, "I am not unacquainted personally with that gentleman at the head of that department of the revenue, and I tremble at the thought of his being at the head of such an immense sum as 86 millions of dollars, and the annual revenue of the Union." In fact, Hamilton handled the cash flow in an impeccable manner. 3/4 of the revenues gathered by the Treasury Department came from commerce with Great Britain. Trade with the former mother country was the crux of everything Hamilton did in government. To fund the debt, bolster banks, promote manufacturing, and strengthen government, Hamilton needed to preserve good trade relations with Great Britain. He understood the displeasure with Britain's trade policy, which excluded American ships from its West Indian colonies and allowed American vessels to carry only American goods into British ports. For Hamilton, these irritating obstacles were overshadowed by larger policy considerations. America had decided to rely on customs duties, which meant reliance on British trade. This central economic truth caused Hamilton repeatedly to poach on Jefferson's turf at the State Department. The overlapping concerns of Treasury and State were to foster no end of mischief between the two men. Hamilton hoped to diversify the revenue stream with domestic taxes. By the time he reported to Congress in December 1790 on the need for additional taxes, he feared that import duties were as high as they could reasonably go. The time had come to spread the pain more evenly, especially since import duties injured seaboard merchants who were part of Hamilton's social circle and political base in New York. No immediate crisis spawned a need for fresh money. By late 1790, Hamilton had actually amassed a sizable government surplus. Government securities had tripled in value under his tutelage, and compared to the disarray under the Articles of Confederation, his policies had produced a healthy burst of economic growth. One Boston correspondent said, "It appears to me that there never was a period when the United States had a brighter sunshine of prosperity. It is pleasing indeed to see the general satisfaction which reigns among every class of citizens in this part of the Union. Our agricultural interest smiles, our commerce is blessed, our manufactures flourish." But at Hamilton's urging, the federal government had now assumed state debts, and Hamilton did not see how he could service them without a secondary source of income. He was boxed in, however, by the already ingrained American aversion to taxation. Direct taxation, whether of people or houses, was anathema to many, and given the strength of agricultural interests and real estate speculators, a land tax could never have been enacted. So what was there left to tax? In December 1790, with other options foreclosed, Hamilton revived a proposal he had floated in his report on public credit, an excise tax on whiskey and other domestic spirits. He knew the measure would be loathed in rural areas that thrived on moonshine, but he thought this might be more palatable to farmers than a land tax. Hamilton confessed to Washington an ulterior political motive for this liquor tax. He wanted to lay hold of so valuable a resource of revenue before it was generally preoccupied by the state governments. As with Assumption, he wanted to starve the states of revenue and shore up the federal government. Jefferson did not exaggerate Hamilton's canny capacity to clothe political objectives in technical garb. There were hidden agendas buried inside Hamilton's economic program, agendas that he tended to share with high-level colleagues, but not always with the public. To Hamilton's delight, Madison supported the excise tax on distilled spirits, agreeing that no plausible alternative existed. Madison averred that as direct taxes would be still more generally obnoxious and as imports are already loaded as far as they will bear, an excise is the only resource, and of all articles, distilled spirits are least objectionable. Madison thought the whiskey tax might even have collateral social benefits, since it would increase sobriety and thereby prevent disease and untimely deaths. In perhaps the first distant rumble of the Whiskey Rebellion that flared up a few years later, the Pennsylvania House of Representatives passed a motion protesting Hamilton's tax. In the mountain hollows of western Pennsylvania, homemade brew was a time-honored part of local culture, and government interference was fiercely resented. As Hamilton worked to pass his liquor tax, William McClay again saw him as the evil wizard of Congress, flitting from the House of Representatives on the first floor of Congress Hall to the Senate chamber on the second, dictating policy to his legislative myrmidons.